Thank you to the three members who are here and the many dozens who are in the audience. If we started taking roll at the beginning, people would be here on time, but they're all busy doing other gameful things, I'm sure. Today we have two items on the agenda. They involve 29 different things, though. We're going to hear from the department talking about healthcare fraud, and I think we're pretty much all against that. But we'll hear more about that. If they want to come to the table and start getting ready, that would be good. I presume they're here. And then we're going to hear from a whole group of people at the end. I think that we'll see how the time goes, and if we're having a really great time talking about health fraud, we'll go past 1:30, but I think we'll see if we can keep it in that time frame and then give people their full minute and a half to say whatever they want to us from the list of 28 people. Hi, introduce yourself, please, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I've most recently taken on the responsibility as the Chief Financial Officer as well. Within my sections are the area of independent or internal audits. I also have responsibility for financial operations. Today we were asked to speak specifically about the case of a former employee who was able to perpetrate a fraud on the agency. And I'll talk a little bit using the Office of the Legislative Auditor's Report as our guide for what. I won't spend a lot of time on what happened, but I'll spend more time on what we've done since we discovered and investigated this fraud, and then what the Office of the Legislative Auditor has recommended that we do, as well as the Department of Management and Budget. If there's other questions about other sorts, other types of fraud, we do have other people from the agency here, but we had assumed the focus would be around this particular case, and so that's where I'll provide testimony today. In front of you is the memo from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. It's dated February 6th. Every year, as you know, the Legislative Auditor takes a look at the finance and compliance activities of each agency. That report isn't done yet, but what they did was to take a look specifically at the case of Ms. Austin and what she was, the fraud that she was able to commit inside the Department of Human Services. Ms. Austin was a long-term employee of the department, and for the last 10 years was a mid to high-level supervisor within the agency that was able to use her expertise and her knowledge to perpetrate this fraud. You can see in the memo, or in the letter from the legislative auditor, that over the course of almost 9 years, 5 years, I'm sorry, she was able to get almost $1 million from the department. If you take a look at the second page, this is where the auditor begins to lay out the faults that they found in our system and in the internal controls at the Department of Management and Budget. So I'd like to go through those and just explain what we've done to address those issues. First of all, Ms. Austin had what we describe as incompatible access and duties, which means she could create a vendor inside of our system. She was able to authorize payments to this particular vendor. She would enter the payments into the accounting system, and then she was able to go to the Department of Finance and use what is called a process of pulling a warrant and have the warrant paid. She had clearly knowledge of the way our system worked and the way the systems work in the Department of Management and Budget, and was a trusted employee was a long-term and trusted employee of the agency. And as a result, we've changed a number of our procedures. We have culled through all of our access inside the agency so that we don't have people with incompatible duties. We started that process, has started that process even before we terminated Ms. Austin's employment. But we are now in a position where we can see who has access to what systems and who has authorization inside of those systems to approve and authorize payments. And on top of that, then the process for oversight on top of those payments. So that's the first issue in our response to the legislative auditor. If you want more detail, Mr. Chairman, let me know. Or if there's questions in each one of these areas, please let me know.
Well, maybe just give us an overview, and I think there will be questions. So just kind of, I think we'll just No, you can fly through what you're going to tell us, and then we'll ask you to dissect it a bit.
Very good. All right. So on the use of the general payment system, most of you know that we make our payments to providers out of what's called the NMIS, the Medicaid Management Information System. In this case, the payments weren't made out of the Medicaid Management Information System. They were made out of the state's accounting system called MAPS. The accounting and procurement system. We've also corrected this problem. There's a complete reconciliation between these two systems, and whenever a payment to a provider is made out of the MAP system, it has to have two or three levels of authorization before we can do so. Now, two issues that were really raised and involve both us and the Department of Management and Budget are the next two. The diversion of payments from the normal delivery process, normally we would mail warrants or make direct deposits. Finance, our Department of Management and Budget would make direct deposits into provider accounts or individual accounts. In this case, the warrants were actually pulled from the system and handed to this particular employee. The Department of Finance, or Department of Management and Budget would probably tell you the same thing about this particular employee. They'd known her for years, had worked with her for years, and she is somebody who had worked with our auditors as well. So they didn't see, none of us saw the signals that we should have seen around what was happening in this case. Finance now has a process. They're not here to speak to us, but they've assured us and the legislative auditor that there's a process around pull warrants that require, in fact, the form that accompanies those warrants documents the rationale for the separate warrant. And if there's more than one pull warrant for a provider or an individual, that we do secondary and tertiary levels of review. And finally, some concern about the lack of follow-up. The Department of Management and Budget had received mailings back from the IRS that they weren't able to locate this provider, which in fact was a fictitious provider, and there was no follow-up. And so the Department of Management and Budget has placed into their procedures a follow-up when they receive those letters back from the IRS that they are not able to find a provider. Those are the four issues that were found by the auditor's office. And how we in the Department of Human Services have addressed them and worked closely with the Department of Management and Budget and the Legislative Auditor's Office so we prevent this from happening again in the future.
Thank you. I have some questions beyond this topic, but I think we'll exhaust this topic first. Do members have questions about this situation? No economist questions? I think we're just so impressed with your work. We have a... Do you have a question? Okay. Maybe you'll think of one. I'm going to ask some other questions. And so you're in charge of thank you. We've heard a little bit about this, and we're kind of glad you're doing some of these things. And, you know, some of those are like, could have thought of that earlier probably, you know, but now you're doing it anyway. And we know there's a case still pending, and there's only so much you can tell us. I think we've gotten used to that, too.
There is a conviction. The sentencing hasn't taken place, there was a plea, and Ms. Austin pled to the crime. So there's more things that are public. Some of the documents are more public, so if people would like them, we certainly can share them.
Yeah, and did you get the money back?
We have made a claim.
Yeah.
I don't think there's an expectation that we will get the money back, but we have made a claim. There was a victim statement made at the time of the plea by the department, but I think it's unlikely.
You can't balance the budget with that money then?
No.
Okay.
No.
You're the auditor for the whole DHS or for this area?
I employ in the compliance office, we have the internal auditors for the agency. So when there is an internal audit of agency activity, the complaint or the issue is raised and taken. We have about six auditors inside the agency in my area. We also have investigators in other parts of the agency, fraud investigators in other parts of the agency, most notably in healthcare and children and family services.
And so, Ms. Berry, at least in terms of what you know, is it mostly complaint driven, or do you have a periodic systematic review you go through on various things just to see how it's going?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. Most recently, we've begun a process of seeking out fraud and abuse. Historically, our system has been complaint-based, and we waited for people to bring issues to us. We have a place where employees can anonymously report abuse. and people use that. They would raise ethics and conflicts of interest questions, and we would follow up. Based upon the Austin case, and for other reasons, we have now started to actively seek out what we see as unusual patterns in people's systems usage or how they access our systems. And it's, we haven't completed that process yet, but we will be spending more time looking for issues than we are reacting.
So do you get down as far as levels of padding time cards on PCA use and hospitals that didn't really give out the aspirin for $5 and all that?
Not, Mr. Chairman, not within our area of the department. We wouldn't make it to that level of detail about a provider. And I'm not even certain I could say that we do so in the healthcare programs area, but I'd let them respond.
Yeah, you look at it thoroughly. Every bill is examined thoroughly, and so no one better be bad, I guess. Thank you, Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I'm coming in sort of through partway of your testimony, so I'm not sure if you've covered this or not, but I think, Mr. Chair, isn't that what it's called internal controls, right? Isn't that what OLA recommended and that they found as a weakness kind of throughout some of the administration? And so with internal controls, you were talking about we go from complaint-based to sort of spot-checking, or checks in place all the time from now on, right, to set a sort of like set for irregularities or around certain financial transactions. I just wondered what it sounded like there was a clampdown throughout all the departments, I hope. I mean, that was a recommendation anyhow.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, each of the auditor's reports this year have noted weaknesses in state agency internal controls. And there was a forum called by management and budget to review all of those internal controls of agencies. And the answer would be yes to all of the kinds of internal controls you're talking about. We would look at where our greatest risks are, and then we would determine what kind of oversight is required. We might just audit a series of, for lack of other detail, somebody's time report or usage of systems to determine if something looks unusual, and then we would follow up and investigate further. So it can be at many different levels, but we want to focus in on the areas of contracts, procurement, and payment systems are the place where we really want to start and where we think we have the highest risk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that addresses it. I think, I find sort of internal controls, that's an interesting term, and I hope that, but as you said, it was noted as a weakness across the system, so I don't know if there's somebody here from the Office of Management and Budget, but hopefully there has been controls put throughout the administration, and I would think, historically, would it vary from administration to administration? I suppose it could, but you would think that at the state level they would want to have these in place all the time, even with changes in administration and personnel and so forth.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, there would be statewide internal controls, which would have addressed some of the issues here in this particular case, and then agencies themselves would have a series of controls. We would probably look much the same, though. We'd rely upon each other's best practices to determine what works, what has worked in other agencies. We can see what the auditor has found in one agency's report, and we will say, is that a problem for us? And then we will actively look to see if it is a problem for us. So there has to be some consistent statewide controls layered with department controls as well. Thank you.
And Ms. Bray, is Commissioner Wilkin over this area, or is that who's your deputy commissioner that oversees this part?
The chief operations officer is Wendy Dwight, and she is my supervisor.
But in the org chart, are you under one of the branches of DHS? Is there a deputy commissioner over you?
Mr. Chairman, there is not a deputy commissioner.
Oh.
And so the chief operating officer reports to the commissioner, but all audit reports do go directly to the commissioner. So those audit reports out of our area do go directly to the commissioner, so he is aware of issues that we are addressing and trying to correct.
I was just curious, in the org system, so you're kind of apolitical. The person head of your department is not hired by whoever the governor or their crew is.
Mr. Chairman, mine is not an appointed position.
Right, and your administrative leader is not either, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, the chief operating officer is not an appointed position either.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, that kind of keeps it out of the fray. And, but to that point, why do we have an internal audit system and not an external audit system like Elliot Ness or somebody? Remember back in the day to come and find. I'm sure you've talked about it. Is there a reason? I'm glad it's separated from the rest of the deputy commissioners and all the back and forth as things change. But do you have an opinion about that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have what I would describe as an external audit function as well in the two of the program areas of our department. In Children and Family Services and in healthcare, we do actively seek out fraud that is perpetrated against the department and against the state by providers and recipients. So that activity does take place. It just doesn't take place in the internal audit or in the compliance audit. We're very involved with many of those investigations. We have forensic capability in the agency that we often use in other parts of the agency, but they don't report up to us.
Yeah, and actually, I appreciate that, and maybe I'm just missing the, you know, compared to, like, let us say, auditor comes in, they're totally fresh, they don't, right. They have, their eyes are totally clear and open, and they just say what they say, and very often, you know, you agree, like, oh yeah, that was a good idea, and it seems like in a department as big as yours, and it's not a criticism of you, I'm just asking a question, that, you know, maybe they'd get to some stuff that you were just thinking that wasn't as important. And do you want to comment about that?
Mr. Chairman, I do think all those different levels of review and audit are very important. One of the principles we operate under is that it's hard to look at yourself and that it's not always in the best practice to do so. So we readily and closely work with the legislative auditors and others so that when they look at us, they're getting the information they need to do that audit. And the same is true of those external controls. You need to know that they are being reviewed outside of what would be their normal program area so that there is some objectivity to the review.
I appreciate that. And just, yeah, if it would be beneficial, you know, we could send more people to help. You know, either from inside or outside, or and actually, it's only a little facetious because maybe we should help you with that. But I don't know if the department bill asked for any additional help or oversight authority, because I think that especially as times lean up, we're interested in you know, proper expenditures of all that, which I know is your number one task, I would expect.
Mr. Chairman, I know the Department of Management and Budget has a budget request for internal auditors on a statewide basis. We have internal auditors in the agency. We're only one of 10 agencies that do have internal auditors. But the Department of Management and Budget wants to increase their capacity to do this on a statewide basis. So there is a budget request for internal auditors, not specifically for human services. Hopefully we benefit from that.
Well, thank you. Representative Gottwolf, I guess the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a question to the testifier. Do we have goals, specific goals for reducing fraud, and are we measuring those, and do we have specific strategies for trying to get at these issues? I mean, obviously, that's money that could be going to help people really need these dollars and these services. It's a concern.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we don't have a baseline, if that's the question, against which to measure the amount of fraud we are able to detect internally. My answer could be supplemented again by people who do the external work in the department. But inside the agency, we're just at a point now where we're beginning to seek out and develop that baseline so we can determine what we believe should be normal use and access inside the agency.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up just real quickly. I know one measure that's been offered is an estimate of about 15% fraud. And if we add up those numbers, I'll cut to the chase, you know, food stamp, TANF, Medicaid, and child care, we're talking, you know, in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 billion, and that's a lot of money. So I think it's very important that we get to a baseline and start addressing it.
Well, I think that's been productive. You get to escape Well, it's still friendly, and I guess hopefully you enjoyed your visit here today, and come again sometime, and thank you. We're going to come to order, so you're off the record even. We have a quorum.
So I don't need to sign in this again.
Are there minutes? Okay. And there's no minutes today. I'm sorry. Can't offer any minutes. The next phase of our meeting here is we have close to 30 people who want to come and talk to us, and if you can do the math, because we got a little extra time, the efficiency gained each of you about 10 seconds, so you're up to an hour, a minute 35 to a minute 45 seconds per person. And these are, while I'm talking, I think you all have a list out there, if you can just follow along. Mr. Coons had a better offer, and he won't be here. So Jody Harpstead, if she wants to come down, if we can just kind of do this. A lot of us have had the carpet worn off by our offices listening to some of the concerns you have, and I think you can assume as the witness that we're aware of a lot of the things. And so part of the reason for you to be short is because of time constraints, but we're not disinterested in what you have to say. And so if there's a novel angle you want to present that we haven't heard, or if you want to say what you came to say, it's your minute and 45 seconds to do whatever you like. And then when Mrs. Harpstead gets done, if people would come down and just kind of go back and forth, and we'll try to, you've got about literally 2 minutes, and 2 minutes goes fast, I want to remind you, and I think you've all been coached that it's going to be a short thing. So, and members, if there's time at the end, we'll maybe recall the most popular speaker, and then you'll know that you were really fruitful, or we want to grill you some more, either way, we're done at 2:30, so. Ms. Harpstead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Say your name for the tape.
My name is Jody Harpstead. I'm Chief Operating Officer at Lutheran Social Services Minnesota, the largest nonprofit human services organization in the state. First, just a moment on what's happening in social service from where we sit. There's still over 5,000 people with disabilities waiting for services. 1,800 youth are homeless in Minnesota every night. You know these numbers. What you may not know is that while we've doubled our capacity in the last 2 years, we still turn away 1,000 people a month who are seeking our debt management and mortgage foreclosure services. We're doing our part along with other nonprofits and companies in Minnesota. We've frozen wages, withheld discretionary contributions to our pension plan, we've closed services that are no longer needed, reduced our workforce, and we're reducing expenses so we can put every dollar possible toward people who need service. We serve 100,000 Minnesotans every year in all 87 counties of the state through 23 lines of service. And so, as such, we have well over 1,000 contracts with various levels of government to do those services, and we think we know something about government purchase of social services. The governor's proposal to create regional purchasing entities is a good start. We fear another layer of government could just add and not take away costs from our system. We offer our own point of view that we can shift spending away from administrative purchasing processes and conserve spending on direct services for people who need them if you do any of the following. Shift more of the purchasing process from the county level to the state level. Most of our sister Lutheran social service organizations in other states do most of their contracting at the state level. Bundle services to multi-service organizations or lead agencies who could subcontract for the services they don't provide themselves. Competitively contract with fewer providers, which is simply a tenet of wise purchasing, and contract with the nonprofit sector for case management to maintain local advocacy for clients. A great example of all these principles is the statewide contract we have to provide case management, family-based and in-office counseling and financial counseling to all of the state's veterans, which the legislature appropriated last session. Our contract process is a single contract process, one lead provider, provides case management and local services to our veterans in their communities in all 87 counties of Minnesota. We're subcontracted to 20-some local partner organizations in spots where we don't have service staff. One particular area of the governor's budget proposal gets our special attention, the 3% rate cut for services for people with disabilities.
Ms. Hart said you just a little over 2 minutes actually already, so it goes quick.
May I finish the sentence?
Please, yeah. I'm not kind of just telling you, you can finish your thought even.
Got it. Any cut in the rate for services with this population without regulatory reform that allows us the opportunity to redesign the business model is not sustainable. As the next forecast rolls out and the House prepares its budget, if rate cuts are necessary in this area, please allow us the offer to redesign our services in a way that will make them available to the largest number of people with the highest safety and quality.
We also urge a reduction in the discount between consumer-directed community supports and traditional services, where not enough families are being offered the opportunity for those options.
Thank you
for your 2 minutes.
No, I just thank you for coming. I think the redesign is something I'm trying to help us with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mark Maxey, legislative representative of AFSCME Council 5. We think we're going to have a difficult session, of course. We think before cutting funding for any program, we need to carefully consider three things. Will it increase the risk of injury or harm to persons served? Will it result in job losses and may worsen the economic downturn and loss of revenues? And third, will it accelerate the closure of institutions such as hospitals and nursing homes that provide a vital role in our safety net and in our state and local economies? There's a few items that are in the budget. I'll just tick them off quickly in the interest of time. Of course, along with a number of others, we have concern over transfer of the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund and the cuts to Minnesota Care, et cetera. We'll want to see what happens, of course, with the stimulus package coming in, how it affects all of that. A specific area, we oppose, there's a proposal to move fraud prevention investigation that's now done in the counties to the state. We have counties like that we represent folks in Ramsey and Hennepin, for example, where we think they do good work. At Ramsey, it's with the county attorney's office. So we think that ought to remain there. Nursing home funding long-term care, you've heard from others. We're part of a coalition of senior workers for quality. You'll hear more from folks, I think, on Thursday on that issue. We've had concerns over cuts in long-term care provider rates, 3% at ICFMRs and DTNHs. Mentioned just two other issues. Healthcare simplification, the department has a proposal on that, and we think we ought to take a hard look at that because given the wasteful track record with Health Match, et cetera, we're skeptical. And finally, there's a proposal, as you may be aware, to, quote, reform pensions at Minnesota Sex Offender Program and Corrections. That whole proposal doesn't belong in these Health and Human Service budgets. It belongs in the Pension Commission. And I'd also add hospital funding. We're concerned about that as well, but you've heard from others. So with that, I'll stop, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. And the Health Match comments always perk us up, and thank you for your advice. So just going great, keep coming down. That was actually about 2 minutes 20 seconds if you're speaking slower, so he gets a bonus because we like him. Hello. Welcome, Mr. Brigham.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tim Burkett, CEO of People Incorporated. I'm here to talk to you in 1 minute and 59 seconds about the governor's proposal to eliminate two of our programs. These programs are one of a kind in the state, both of them. They're in the base. The program, you'll see two sheets. One is the program for people with seizure disorders. This program was put in the base in 1999, although it's more than a 20-year-old program. It's the only program in the state that serves people with serious and intractable epilepsy, and within a year or a year and a half moves them to total independence at a real cost to the taxpayer, a real savings to the taxpayer. And you can read the details of this in your handout. The other one are Safe Haven services. I came to you about in 2007 after we had raised money from more than 900 people to open the one-of-a-kind program in the state to help people with mental illness who live outside come in partnership with the University of Minnesota and have 24/7 psychiatric and professional support. That program also is very cost effective. In an average of 145 days, we move all these folks, or more than 90% of these folks, again, you can look at your sheet, toward independence, and we move them into their own places. So both of these groups get off the welfare roll. We're the only ones who are doing it in the state, and I don't know what the governor was thinking.
Okay, well, thank you. That's your time, and I appreciate it. And also, the epilepsy program is a impressive program, so thank you. So keep going. Hello, you're Ms. Meyer, are you?
Hi, I am Heidi Meyer. I talk with a smile, and please do not take it away from me.
My name is Heidi Meyer. I live in Dakota County, West St. Paul. I am here today to ask you to stop Governor Pawlenty to eliminate dental services to adults on medical assistance and Minnesota Care. I would like to tell you about the Minnesota Medical Assistance MA dental care problems of myself and others. I was born with dental problems. My mom and dad found out when I went to my first dentist appointment how bad it was. My mouth was too small for all the normal teeth. Some teeth were coming in on top of each other, and surgery was needed to get the teeth and face lined up. There were years of follow-up doing different things. My mom and dad paid for a lot of dental work and surgery to keep my mouth healthy when I was a child. When I was 19, with my disability, my dad was told by the doctor to sign me up on medical assistance MA that came with dental care as a part of it. And when I was in the first group home, I got dentists that would take medical assistance MA people. And when I had my first dentist on medical assistance, it made it so I did not have to go to the ER to have a bad tooth looked at. It took a very long time to find a dentist. It took a very long time to find a new dentist. A human services worker who had known me in the past finally helped me find a dentist who will take medical assistance. I would have very bad teeth if I did not have assistance to dental care services. So, help me keep my dentist and my healthy teeth for years to come. I talk with a smile, and please do not take it away from me. Help me and others keep our teeth healthy for life. Thank you for letting me tell my story to you. I am available to answer questions or comments.
Thank you for coming. We hope you can keep your smile and stay at the table. People at the table are very interested in helping that to happen. So that's very good. Thank you very much.
I hope I'm able to boast as much when I'm done, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Hancock. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, serving the 7-county metro area of Minneapolis-St. Paul. All of our services, including our personal care tenant program, are designed to enable individuals with disabilities to live self-directed lives. Because thus far in the session, so much of the discussion around disability services and DHS and PCA services in particular have been the result of the legislative auditor's report, even to the point that it's informed the governor's recommendation, I'd like to use that legislative auditor's report as the format for some of my comments today. The legislative auditor's report reported that it collected data from 25 agencies across the state of Minnesota for its findings. It also reported that there are approximately 600 agencies of various sizes and sophistication, providing PCA services in the state of Minnesota. That means that the report was produced on a 4.1% random sample basis. The auditor also reported that a thorough investigation of timesheets from 299 personal care tenants from across the state of Minnesota. There are over 45,000 direct service professionals in the state of Minnesota today. This thorough evaluation amounts to a random sample of less than 1%. Most researchers, I'm sure, would agree that this makes for a very, very small random sample. The auditor also reported a situation involving 254 hours worked in one day by a single care professional that was reported with great fanfare and sensationalism. The unfortunate part of it was that it was simply a clerical error. The provider agency mistakenly filled all of the daily hours for the organization under a single provider number rather than the individual provider numbers assigned to each individual worker. In this case, the problem was immediately identified. Investigators visited with the provider, determined the problem, provided instruction and training for the provider, and the situation was corrected. Provider error revealed, error investigated, error corrected. It seems like the system and the safeguards in this situation worked pretty well, as intended. Okay. One final point, a point that I would make, and I'll jump ahead, is that, you know, we all generally recognize that we all have to share in the pain and we all want to be part of the solution. And you'll hear from other colleagues that will be coming up after me that there are many of us who are prepared and ready to work with the committee, with the department, and others to find an equitable solution that allows individuals to continue to live self-directed lives and prevent far more costly out-of-home placements. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hancock, forget this tremendous work, and it's worth 2 minutes and 20 seconds to hear about it.
thank you.
And I didn't set the rules. I just implemented it.
I understand.
Here, so thanks you can come.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. You can step away from the table, too. I hope you can come again and talk to the members individually. Have a good day. And maybe if, Ann, you want to come and sit with your friend there, too. Oh, who's the... Is it Steve Larson and Jeff Nachbar? Steve, it's on that. You're on the same, you have a shared time with somebody, Adam. Is that true? So,
I guess.
Take all the time you want. You got 2 minutes between you. So, are you saying the same thing?
Steve Larson with the Arc of Minnesota. No, Mr. Chair, we're not
okay.
saying the same thing. But
okay, well.
I get to be the good cop, and Jeff is the bad cop today.
Okay, well, you can have Dave Coons' time then, and I'll give Jeff your time. How's that? So, you get a minute 59 apiece.
Minnesota has developed a service system that supports individuals and older Minnesotans in the community. But that service system can be improved, and we want to continue to move towards a self-directed system that meets the individual needs of both persons with disabilities and older Minnesotans. The governor's budget does have some recommendations in it that move us towards a self-directed system. These items include the implementation of a COMPASS assessment. We feel strongly that this needs to be implemented and so that there's an assessment that works consistently for all individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans so we can identify the appropriate level of services that they need. We support strongly the administrative improvements in the PCA program that David Hancock spoke about just a few before us. Dealing with the issues identified in the legislative auditor's report that need to be fixed, because we think every dollar in that program should be spent for the services it was intended to be spent for. We also applaud the efforts in the governor's budget to comply with federal compliance with the waiver program so that we retain those dollars, and we would also will be working on making sure that the Department of Human Services is complying with federal compliance in regards to quality assurance within the waiver program.
See, that's about time. Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden. We'll be hearing from you again, I'm sure. Mr. Nachbar, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nachbar. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Brain Injury Association and the other co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. We need to turn this ship around. The items in the governor's budget that erode our community-based supports include, and I'll just take them off, a 3% cut to providers of services, limiting growth in disability waiver programs by cutting, by capping the amount of waivers available. We see about $85 million worth of personal care assistance services by tightening who qualifies and then further restricting the benefits available for those that ultimately do qualify. It eliminates the community quality assurance program. It eliminates dental services. It eliminates occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech therapy for folks on MA. And it reduces the personal needs allowance by $32. As I said, we need to turn this ship around. We look forward to working with the committee. We are working on ideas on how we can help promote savings and have that conversation with you. And finally, we think all Minnesotans should contribute to the budget solution this year. And the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities has endorsed the Invest Minnesota proposals for a fair and equitable tax increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nachbar. Actually, you were just as nice as Steve if you were supposed to be a bad cop. But thank you for coming. Ms. Henry, hello.
I'll start talking while I'm sitting down. My name is Anne Henry, and Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and we represent children and adults with long-term and significant disabilities across the state, including mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic conditions, brain injuries. I'm just going to talk very quickly about the PCA proposals on page 63 to 66. First, let me say that we support the legislative auditor's recommendations for change, but the auditor did not recommend throwing thousands of people off PCA services, and it's really important, I urge you to keep that in mind as we move ahead. We wish the auditor would have spent a little more time on explaining to you why the program has grown in this decade. This is our safety net program for people to stay out of institutions and out of home placement. It is very sensitive to any changes made. The disability waiver programs, as some of you well know, were cut and frozen during this decade. So the PCA program is the only option. The other not so well known change in this decade in terms of its impact on PCA are the changes to our mental health system.
We changed from long-term beds in regional treatment centers and Rural 36 facilities to short-term clinical intensive services. The group that has grown the most in PCA has been people with mental illness. And in fact, children and adults with mental illness are disproportionately affected by the cuts. And when you add dual diagnosis children with BD and mental health, it's kids with autism. Those are the folks that are mainly going to be cut off this program. So let me just quickly say that...
You have 10 whole seconds to take your time.
Okay. You have a handout. I recommend it to you, and we will continue to work on this. But know that this program is our safety net. Without it, we will see a lot of people going back to facilities because there's no option. Thank you.
And this time, you know what's on all of our minds. And I do want to... I got four letters today from people like cerebral palsy and stuff. They're not losing their PCAs under anybody's proposal. So I hope that, they're more assured than some I...
Well, Mr. Chair, 6,600 people will be cut an average of 2 hours a day. So people do have a lot to lose. Everybody does on the proposal.
Thank you. But I hope people understand what's even proposed. So welcome, Ms. Abdel-Holden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Abdel-Holden, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Minnesota. We're thankful that the important infrastructure investments for the mental health system that you made in 2007 remain mainly intact. We're supportive of the state takeover of the room and board costs for children who are in residential treatment. We're pleased to see an increase in the partial hospitalization rate for children so that we can provide that much-needed intensive community support and address the waiting list for the service. And we support allowing children's crisis teams to have some flexibility so that they can reach families in all 87 counties. NAMI's concerned about the loss of health insurance for people on Minnesota Care, Transitional Minnesota Care, and DAMC, who will not be able to access treatment when and where they need it. 30% of people on Minnesota Care use mental health services. We're concerned about the 6% cut to hospitals, who will have a difficult time absorbing that cut in their rates. And while we appreciate DHS's honesty in recognizing that these cuts will increase the use of state-operated services, we're appalled that we would take any actions to increase the number of commitments in the state. We're concerned about the cut to community providers who are already hanging on by their fingernails. We would have behavioral health aides if rates were increased. And then there's the reduction in PCA services that will leave many children and adults with mental illness with no in-home support. And lastly, since last week you ran out of time, and I'm talking as fast as I can, to hear my testimony on the mental health maintenance of effort, I just want to point out that despite some advances in our mental health system, it remains in a very precarious state, and the county funds make up close to 25% of the community mental health dollars and 15% of the total mental health spending, and reducing or eliminating these funds could cause deterioration in our mental health system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And just to pick up on one thing you mentioned, and I thank you for getting it all in, because every word is important, and you have a lot to say. Some of the fiscal notes that were given were not fully dynamic, and so if there's things that were shown as savings that may have another element that we'd like to know about, that would be very productive along the way. So you can't help yourself. You have 15 seconds.
Mr. Chair, can you please explain minimal dynamism, minimally dynamic fiscal notes for me? I'm really kidding.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Brand, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I'm speaking on behalf of our members that provide mental health services in around 130 different locations for children and families and adults. Our provider members are safety net providers, and they sue services without regard to people's ability to pay. And each service that they do is funded by a mix of sources. Some of it's philanthropy, some of it's medical assistance, some of it's county funds. It's really a three-legged stool or a house of cards, and each piece of that is necessary for the stool to stand. Financial health of the providers was already shaky prior to our current economic crisis. The failure to provide mental health services predictably leads to hospital ER events, difficulty for people to return to work, failure, school dropouts, increased disability claims. We're in this budget, we're particularly concerned about the cumulative effects of rate cuts, lost eligibility, and changes to how clients qualify for key support services. Specifically, eligibility changes would eliminate coverage for many 100,000 people. There are already centers that have people who are uninsured and underinsured more than ever before. A 3% cut to psychiatric services, rehabilitative services, child community support services creates a budget hole that will result in laying off staff and closing sites or reducing hours. rate cuts combined with cuts to counties and changes in the county system will have an impact on the services. Think of the three-legged stool. Partial hospitalization services could be provided by community nonprofits. Tighter criteria for PCAs or waiver services will all but eliminate these services for people with mental illness. What alternatives do we have available to offer the families? Thank you very much.
Thank you, and that's on our mind too. So, welcome, sir. Please identify yourself. And
my name is Ed Idy. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. It's estimated that 14,000 Americans lose their health care every day. I'm sure you all know someone who recently lost their job or their health care. I've been providing services to people either living in poverty or on the edge for over 30 years. Whenever cuts are prescribed, they're the first in line. How can we continue to do this? It's estimated that 113,615 fewer adults and 26,399 children will be enrolled in the state health plan by 2011. That's more people than live in Rochester and Winona combined. There are discussions in Washington regarding health care for everyone. At a time when the ill effects of a recession impact all of us, is not a time to cut people off health care. It's a time to look instead at health care for all. We need to think boldly, not oldly. A public health model allows all citizens to be healthy, not just the chosen few. In one specific primary care clinic, it was found that 40% of the patients had a diagnosable mental illness when health was discussed from a holistic perspective. This is certainly early intervention. As the stressors of our current economic situation affect more people, this becomes even more important. By removing people from access, we replace a more preventive, less restrictive, less costly health care. If people don't have access to health care, they will work differently, live differently, and maybe without appropriate medications, regardless of their illness. Then if something goes wrong, the most likely medical care becomes the hospital, the most costly and unnecessary, most restrictive treatment. And who ends up paying for this anyway? More money for commitments is costly and personally defeating. We're hearing from more employers about the stress their employees are under. We hear from employees that they are foregoing many things in order to have money for co-payments, etc. How far can we go until we see many more people untreated for their illnesses? There are some innovative ideas coming forward. Consolidation of services, sharing purchasing, even combining county services into regional collaboratives. Again, I suggest it is time for bold thinking, not old thinking. We cannot simply balance the budget with cuts. Revenues must be on the table also. Thank you for your time today, and I wish you the best of luck in your bold decision-making.
Thank you, Mr. Idy. And just as, you know, these are all very whistle-stop kind of visits and overviews, but as you have thoughtful proposals, the carpet in our front of our doors should be worn out more with your good ideas and coming to visit us. So, welcome.
Hello, I'm Dr. Scott Lingle. I'm a general dentist in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Dental Association. I'd like to address two issues, the elimination of adult dental care from the public care program and the elimination of the critical access provider dental program. The elimination of adult dental care is going to have a dramatic effect on the health of people in Minnesota, and you will not save money, you will simply cost shift. We've already heard from one of our previous speakers that when you have a toothache and you can't afford it, you go to the emergency room, and there you get a shot of Novocaine, a bottle of penicillin, a bottle of Vicodin, and a week later you're right back there. If you provide the dental care, the treatment is done, they're comfortable, they're healthy, and you don't get these repeated visits over and over at a highly expensive rate. The state of Michigan did the same thing a few years ago where they dropped dental care. They reinstituted the program when they saw the costs that were coming through the medical program. Recent research has shown conclusively the link between dental disease and the increased risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes complications. I love it when my cardiologist is telling people to floss. These are very expensive conditions to treat, and it's going to really increase the expense to Minnesota. You will not save money, and you will jeopardize the health of people in Minnesota. Secondly, the elimination of the critical access provider program. For years, we've talked about dental access in these hearings, and it's been an underfunded program, one of the lowest in the country. The critical access provider program has really increased access. It's been very successful. If we lose that, these clinics to see a high percentage of these low-income patients are going to lose this overhead expense, and we're going to see dental access be much worse than it's ever been before. So I urge you to please preserve adult dental care and the critical access provider program. Thank you.
Dr. Lingle. Exactly. Whoa. Well, Dr. Gowan, the bar has been raised here. Welcome to the, and actually raised is what you had to say too, notwithstanding the time, so welcome.
My name is Dr. Jim Gowan, and I'm the Associate Dental Director with Health Partners, and actually my colleague covered a lot of the points that I had down, so hopefully I can stay under the 2 minutes. I am here to speak in opposition to the Governor's recommendation to eliminate dental services for non-pregnant public program patients, and also to keep in place the critical access payment that we have now. Under the governor's proposed cutback, about 25,000 adults with Health Partners dental insurance would lose their coverage. And this includes 13,000 adults who receive care at our Health Partners dental clinics. These cutbacks obviously will not eliminate the need for dental services, but will result in patients needing to seek care through more expensive emergency room routes. It's important to understand that the care of this population is not elective in nature, but rather is essential. In 2007, nearly 1,400 patients were seen at Regents Hospital for dental pain for preventable conditions such as abscess teeth. Care for patients in emergency rooms for dental pain is very ineffective because emergency rooms are not set up to provide this type of care. As Dr. Lingle said, primarily what will happen is you get a prescription, leave, and then come back sometime later for another prescription. Another point that I would like to emphasize is the significant link now that research is showing between oral health and systemic health. Diabetes, heart disease, and stroke are three of the primary ones that that we see. Finally, regarding the critical access payments, I would like to speak against the proposed elimination of these dollars for Health Partners and other clinics that have decided to make a commitment to serve the underserved population. We have built our care delivery system around a model that improves the health services for all. We treat all patients the same, and we see delivering exceptional care as a privilege of being a health care provider in Minnesota. Doing so, however, comes at an economic cost. The reimbursement rates for public programs fall well short of the cost to deliver care, and the critical access dollars do help to close that gap. They don't allow us to realize a profit, but we do at least break even on the population. So in conclusion, again, I would strongly urge this committee to go forth with a recommendation to maintain benefits as they currently are, and also to speak out against the elimination of the critical access dollars.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming down today. Why is dental optional in the MA program anyway? That's a rhetorical question, but it's one of the surprises to me. So.
Yeah, it shouldn't be.
Right. Ms. Commit, welcome to the committee, and you drew the long straw today. You get the privilege of coming in. You know, Senator Bergen gives 3 minutes. We're not quite as nice as her, obviously. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate being here. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm the Director of Policy at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Our 8 nonprofit members provide coverage to more than 4 million people. The consequences of the governor's proposed cuts are severe, including sicker Minnesotans as people without coverage delay or avoid treatment, insurance premium increases for Minnesota's employers as unpaid costs are shifted to the private market, insolvent or financially unstable hospitals and clinics, including mental health centers and community clinics, and the decline of public health that increased numbers of unemployed Minnesotans as healthcare organizations lay off more workers. We understand the severity of the budget deficit and believe that every part of the state budget must share in the solution. Eliminating coverage for low-income Minnesotans does not eliminate their need for healthcare services. Often, uninsured individuals do not seek care until they're very ill, ending up in the emergency rooms requiring expensive treatment. Of course, this increases uncompensated care costs and strains our capacity for emergency and disaster preparedness. It is also an indirect tax on employers and families. Those emergency room costs will be shifted onto those who are covered by insurance, resulting in increased premiums. It is short-sighted and ill-advised to add further cost shifts by reducing coverage and cutting payment rates. Uncompensated care increases may put hospitals and clinics in financial risk of insolvency. The state's health care programs were intended to assist Minnesotans in difficult economic times, and now is the time to reinforce that commitment, not to abandon it. We believe there are opportunities contained in the governor's budget related to the program reforms in the PCA program that should be seriously considered. Finally, we also believe that the National Priorities Partnership, setting a national agenda for health care quality and safety, contains recommendations that would address some of the real costs in the system without reducing coverage. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. We'll see you again. Dr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Dr. Noel Peterson, President of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA's foremost concern with the proposed budget is the damage that it does to the health care safety net. Adults on Minnesota Care would lose eligibility. Eligibility for medical assistance would fall to 100% of the federal poverty guidelines. Even more people will be affected as they lose their jobs in this economic downturn. It is wrong to balance the budget on the backs of these citizens. At this point, the governor seems to acknowledge that he will have to reinstate many of the eligibility cuts to maximize the federal stimulus money. Under the budget proposal, the Health Care Access Fund would be eliminated and collected provider taxes transferred to the general fund. MMA strongly opposes this transfer of the tax money. The proposed budget cuts payment to physicians, hospitals, and other outpatient services by 3%. The state has provided only one across-the-board physician increasing physician reimbursement in the past 16 years, a 3% raise in 2000. Physician payment for fee-for-service programs are based on median charges of 1989. Last year's health care reform legislation seeks to provide higher quality, more transparent health care, and seeks ways to control costs through public health initiatives, transparency itself, coordination of care, universal coverage, payment reform, and development of an essential benefit set. That set has potentially would be less expensive and less extensive than what is currently available in our public programs. For healthcare transformation to work, it must be continued. We understand the need for cuts, but the cuts must not and cannot fall disproportionately on the low-income Minnesotans. MMA looks forward to working with you for an equitable solution.
Thank you very much. I think you were 2 seconds short. So.
I'll take those.
That's how we know. It was nice to meet you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Julie Ring. I'm the director of the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, and as a typical Minnesotan, I don't know if I can even say hello or goodbye in 2 minutes.
Well.
So I've decided to abandon my notes and try and make one point. And that is, I know you have a hard task ahead of you with this budget, and all that we ask is that you try to take a balanced approach to cuts in upstream prevention programs, systems, and crisis intervention. These are all really important needs in the state. They're all critical, and we know they're all going to face cuts. From a public health perspective, we hope that the cuts don't hit disproportionately on upstream prevention, which can be done in times like this because those programs don't pay off for a longer period of time. But we won't stem the tide of crisis intervention if we don't invest in prevention. And to that end, we ask that you consider maintaining investments in the statewide health improvement program. I've provided you with a handout, which is aimed at reducing healthcare costs over time and hopefully reducing some of our costs so we don't face the situation again. We ask that you maintain investments in systems like electronic health records that we know will create a more efficient and safe environment for patients, both in the public and private setting. And I know I'll have a chance to talk to all of you individually about some of our more direct topics, but with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
Ms. Ring, the chair of the committee, were he here, would have made some nodding comment about the SHIP program. So wherever he is, he's nodding his head for you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity today. My name is Bridget Siljander. I'm a personal care attendant, PCA, the president of the Direct Support Professional Association of Minnesota, DSPAM. I hold a bachelor's degree in psychology summa cum laude from the University of Minnesota. I'd like people to know that I'm a very educated PCA. DSPAM is opposed to a number of the governor's recommended budget cuts to disability services and PCA services. PCAs can't afford cuts, and PCAs can't afford reductions to wages. Let me just illustrate this briefly with my personal story. I have been a PCA for over 10 years, and during the time that I worked full-time as a PCA, I took on as many hours as humanly possible. However, I was still qualifying for public assistance benefits, visiting my local food shelf, and living in subsidized housing. In my situation, I could not have afforded any cuts to my wages. I believe in the importance of the PCA role in our communities, and I am proud of my work ethic and my standard of practice. I seek to raise the bar in everything that I do. Being a PCA or another type of direct support professional ought to be considered a profession that people are able to commit to and feel proud to do. Other jobs in the community service sector are police officers, nurses, teachers, and public officials. PCAs and other direct support professionals should be elevated to the same standing in society with proper regard. I would like you to consider adopting new language in the DHS and in the state statutes to recognize all support staff as direct support professionals as the primary and preferred title. Referring to support staff as professionals challenges social perceptions and empowers the workers and raises expectation and accountability across the board. This is why my suggestion today is to adopt this language that is inclusive and respectful towards PCAs and other direct support professionals. My organization, the University of Minnesota's Research and Training Center on Community Living, the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, and others have chosen to categorize all persons in direct care and direct support as direct support professionals. This is our umbrella title that encompasses a multitude of job titles. One of the problems in this field is the pervasive fragmentation that exists, and this is exemplified in one way in the estimated 100 different job titles.
And this goes under one of the problems also is this time. So actually, okay. A little over, but I actually, if that name change would be helpful, that's actually so. Probably free compared to some things we get.
Well, let me just conclude with this situation, with all of the many different job titles, confuses who and what is defined as direct support, and this leads to disempowerment and misinformed decision-making that affects these staff. Thank you.
And thank you for your service, and if you recognize one of the members, you could bring your idea to them. Maybe they could put it into a bill.
Okay, so that would be great.
Thanks for coming today. Mr. Midnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Ms. We have a lot of questions for you.
I guess not.
I'm sure you do, and I'm looking forward to them. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. I know our position will be a hard sell for the chair, but I'm here today in opposition to express our opposition to the governor's proposed elimination of chiropractic services for adults on medical assistance, general assistance medical care, and Minnesota care. The fiscal note in the budget page in the governor's proposal shows a $1.2 million savings in the first biennium, and we take exception with that number. We don't think in the long run or even the short term that this will actually add savings to those programs or to the state of Minnesota. Chiropractic has proven to be the lowest cost service in the lowest cost setting, and we think the elimination of this service is actually contrary to the efforts on health care reform that have been pursued over the last number of years. By elimination of the chiropractic services, you will be shifting costs to higher cost medical services, increasing ER visits, increasing hospital admission rate, the number of days in a hospital, outpatient surgeries and procedures, and pharmaceutical costs at all. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would urge your opposition to the governor's proposal in this regard, and thank you for your time.
We actually get done early. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, actually, we have 20 seconds for a question, if you want.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know if we were allowed to ask.
Well, we're not. He has 20. He has 15 seconds.
Well, I just want to know if you have any research to back that up. And if there is some, I guess I'd like to see it. We don't have to have that today, but I just want to know if that's evidence-based.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes. And we'd be happy to share it with you, and we will get that information to you.
Thank you. So,
how about that?
Okay, we're still on time. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Brick, and I'm from Midway Training Services. I'm representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition and MNDACA, trade organizations of small nonprofit companies which operate over 275 programs providing employment, life skills training, and other supports to about 14,000 people with developmental disabilities. In 2006, the last year in which the department gathered statewide data, 58% of our program participants were employed in partnerships with 6,000 businesses and earned over $46 million in wages. I will briefly comment on just a couple of proposals. The first is the proposed 3% reduction in provider rates. While at first blush, 3% may seem like a small amount to absorb, in reality, many of our members would have extreme difficulty doing so without cutting direct support professional positions, wages, or benefits like health insurance. The reason is that about 70% of our members' expenses are personnel related. Since 2003, private providers have been allocated rate increases of only 7.5%, while inflation has grown by 18.5%. The only places left to cut are personnel related. We are very close to reaching the tipping point where the philosophy of expecting more for less is likely to result in the dismantling of the community-based service system for persons with disabilities. The proposal to reduce the waivered services allocation and block grant CCSA funding will formalize a path we've been traveling on for the past few years. Access to support services will be even more dependent upon one's zip code, year of birth, and living arrangement. We believe there are various other factors which should drive access to essential support services. Mr. Chair, we have comments on various other proposals, and we will try to gather those comments and give them to individual members throughout the next few weeks. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And Mr. Brick, you know what you're telling us is heavily on our mind. So thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Ann Blade. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Visiting Nurse Agency, which provides the public health nursing for the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. We provide direct nursing services to over 6,700 clients in their home, 1,400 adults, and 5,300 mothers and babies. I'm here today for two reasons. The first is to let you know what our nurses are seeing in the homes of patients we serve as a result of foreclosure and job loss. There is an increase in pest-infested households. Clients who have been displaced through foreclosure of rental property have to accept extreme substandard housing infested with rats, mice, cockroaches, and bed bugs. This is for the young and the old alike. Our nurses are seeing clients who are suffering the physical effects of bed bug bites and infected scabs. We're seeing crowded and chaotic households, multi-generational families coming together, and different families coming together, up to 20 people in two-bedroom apartments. We are getting requests for infant formula from our donor base. It's increased by 500% in the last 2 months. And for older adults, especially our palliative and dying patients, they don't have the nutritional supplements of Boost, and we are getting requests 4 times what we normally have. The MVNA food shelf that is supplied by our own employees that was bountiful in December is now bare. The financial meltdown has become a significant public health problem, and I know that most of our patients that we serve couldn't come here today to let you know what they're experiencing. The second reason I'm here is to represent the Home Care Association, whose members provide home health service throughout the state of Minnesota. We really appreciate the major financial challenges you face. We really understand that. We also know that many patients want to stay at home, and their nurse is the lifeline for many of the families, especially those patients that I have described. Home care must be viewed as preventive service, delaying more expensive care. Although MVNA has to raise about additional dollars from the community besides third-party reimbursement to serve our clients, many of our agencies rely solely on third-party and would not be able to provide the quality care needed for patients to stay at home if reimbursement continues to be cut. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Is Karen Larson here? Oh, thank you guys. Okay. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance, and I'm here to talk about our elimination in the governor's proposed budget on page 78. Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance and Licensing System was built in 1995 by a group of stakeholders in southeast Minnesota. The system is a community-built, community-run licensing and quality assurance system that continually improves and enhances the quality of life and supports for people with disabilities. In 2005, the Center for Minnesota Medicaid Services brought forth a new quality framework that emphasized that quality assurance systems need to be looking at actual outcomes and not just planning. Not just minimum standards, but quality indicators like individual choice, relationships, and job satisfaction. Moreover, that these outcomes should be determined in part by the individual receiving services and not just their providers. The federal government has stated that Minnesota needs a quality assurance system that meets their quality framework. Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance meets and exceeds the CMS quality framework standards. Bottom line, Minnesota Region 10 has been doing licensing and quality assurance for 10 years. The providers, the families, guardians, teachers, case managers, and providers involved in that licensing system like the way it works. keep funding and supporting the Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance System, please.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kelly Bodine from Possibilities of Southern Minnesota, located in Rochester. We are a community and vocational provider organization for individuals with disabilities. I'm here with Karen today to talk about the Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance Project. Wanted to give you a brief commentary on the provider perspective. Karen and the folks over at Region 10 have talked a lot about how this licensing system is driven by the people who receive services. We feel that this is the best way to do licensing, the most efficient way and the most person-centered way to do licensing. We as a provider personally benefit from this service in our region, and we are not alone as provider organizations. In Region 10, there are many, many providers who invest staff time, consumer time, to be a part of this licensing system. This is truly, I'm looking for my quote here, Region 10 Quality Assurance is citizen and community engagement and public policy at its very best. What Region 10 QA allows us to do is for us to be able to participate and define what quality means. We, again, are not alone as a provider organization and appreciate the ability to work with Region 10 in terms of taking control and taking responsibility for the services that we are providing individuals with disabilities in Minnesota. Again, public policy not only needs to make good fiscal sense, but also provided citizens with the support they are entitled to as human beings. The Region 10 QA project does just that. And the final quote that I would want to leave with you today, the care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government. And that is from Mr. Thomas Jefferson.
Thank you for
Thank
coming.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, an association of about 150 providers who provide services in the waiver services, ICF, Tamar, Sills. Altogether, our members employ about 27,000 caregivers. I want to just talk real quickly about a double whammy. Now, we all realize and I hope it's spread across the board and all participants and people who are funded in state government and not singled out into a particular area, but we're subject to a double whammy. The governor, as you know, in his budget proposes tax breaks for some businesses. Well, my folks, the people at ARM, not only provide support to our most vulnerable people, but businesses too. And in his budget, we have a 3% cut that might go up, and a huge, we call it a fee, but we would call it a tax increase on our businesses. In the first year, of 64%, and in the second year, cumulatively, 127%. We understand that you're going to have to make some difficult decisions, but with this kind of double whammy, the impact will obviously be on people, be on direct support staff, it'll be on the quality of life, and hopefully not, but getting close to the very safety of our most vulnerable people. Whatever's left of health insurance for caregivers may be very well eroded. Mr. Chair, you talked about reform.
You got about 10 seconds to talk about reform.
And Ms. Herbstedt talked about it. You are, thank you very much, a co-author of the ARM bill that Representative Thiessen is authoring that does provide for some immediate reforms and a long-term roadmap. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is Mr. Skandrick here? Or his proxy? And if Jessica Webster can come down, please. Is Michael here? Is there Jessica Webster? Okay, hi. So if Mike shows up, you can come at the end. But go ahead.
Thank
Welcome
you,
to the committee.
Members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm here with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal assistance to low-income people across the state. We're saddened, and quite frankly, we're frightened by how devastating these cuts could be to low-income families across the state. Today, we're here to oppose particularly the cuts that start at page 49. We're particularly concerned about the $125 SSI penalty that would be imposed on MFIP grants of parents and children with disabilities. Legal Aid was preparing itself for cuts and what those cuts might look like. We thought there might be a temporary suspension of employment services. We thought we'd see higher caseloads. What we weren't prepared for was a cut that takes money from 7,000 of the state's most vulnerable families. They're not only poor, they're often disabled and they're ill.
and it would be a really devastating cut. And on a more technical point, we hope that the state will do a really careful analysis of how these MFIP cuts may jeopardize our chances to receive economic stimulus funds, and also how these cuts might affect our work participation rate in the future and put us at risk. In closing, we just hope that when you're making these difficult budget decisions, you're not looking to families that can afford it the least. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Is Paul Bono here? Did he come up from Albert Lee? Julie Johnson. Are you Mr. Bono?
No.
Okay. Are you Julie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not Julie Johnson. I'm okay. Here in her place. My name is Jeff Lindu, representing Minnesota Pharmacists Association and Minnesota Retailers. I work with Thrifty White Pharmacies. We are a Minnesota-based rural pharmacy chain. A 1% cut in AWP may not seem significant, but I need to stress that that translates to about a 5% cut in reimbursement to a pharmacy. The last increase to pharmacy reimbursement for Medicaid was in 1980-something. Since then, we've had multiple fee cuts, including the last 3 years. So that today, our pharmacies are being paid by Medicaid about $2.14 per prescription less than we were being paid 2 years ago. The department indicates that they need this cut in order to get the reimbursement for Medicaid more in line with the private sector. Of the top 10 plans in Minnesota, Minnesota Medicaid is the lowest average reimbursement. They are about $1.91, according to our company records, below the average of those 10 plans. Our concern is there are 149 communities in the state of Minnesota that have only one pharmacy. All of the citizens in those communities rely on that one pharmacy for pharmacy services. If you've ever heard the expression having a wolf by the ears, I can't think of a better way to describe the dilemma of a community pharmacy and the Minnesota Medicaid contract. To hold it up and look at it and say, I don't dare hang on and I don't dare let go. We are very concerned about access, particularly in the rural communities. Thank you for your time.
And Mr. Linder, is it Mr.? Thanks for coming. I'm troubled by that. We've been talking about that a lot and trying to find some way to keep you open. So please stay open and hang on. So thanks for coming.
Thank you very much.
The podiatric group, are they here? I didn't see them in the audience. Mary Regan, you want to come down? Podiatric.
Thank
Welcome.
You, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents and their families. Our members provide services ranging across the continuum of care, including in-home treatment services, day treatment, therapeutic foster care, group residential care, intensive mental health residential treatment, and corrections programs. I would echo many of the comments that you've heard already today, in particular about the changes in PCA services, Minnesota Care, reduction in benefits, but I'm going to limit my testimony to a few areas that you haven't heard as much about. You have heard about the 3% rate cut for providers, but I want to tell you in particular about a group of providers known as Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, or CTSS. These are the folks that go into the homes of families of children who cannot make it to the clinic to get therapy services. They provide mental health services to those children. A recent study conducted by Hennepin County of their providers showed that up to 50% of the services these folks are providing are not reimbursed at all. So a 3% cut in the services that are reimbursed really will jeopardize the viability of these programs. As Mr. Nelson mentioned, the licensing fee increases hurt our members significantly. AFED program that is currently licensed at a $400 licensing fee will jump to $4,400, a very significant increase. An area of the budget that we're not yet ready to say whether we support or oppose but have some concerns about is what's being called the North Star Act.
and that is an effort to equalize payments for foster parents, adoptive parents, and relative care providers. That's a great goal. It makes sense to equalize those payments, but the way it's being done is by reducing the payments being made to foster parents, and we're quite concerned about that. Therapeutic foster care, in particular in Minnesota, offered by private agencies in some counties, is a community-based level of care being provided to children with very serious mental health problems. If we reduce the payments to those families, we're concerned that they will not be able or willing to continue to provide that care, and again, we will see movement into more restrictive levels of care. Overall, I would say that our concern is that the governor's budget proposal appears to jeopardize the viability or availability of some of the least expensive, least restrictive supports for children and families, in-home services, day treatment, PCAs, and foster care. Our concern is that this could lead to increased use of more expensive and restrictive services in the long term. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming down. Jonathan, you want to talk about community clinics since Michael wasn't here? Or do you are you hoping to avoid that? Is there anybody else in the audience who, we have room for one more person after that. If there's some public person who wants to come down and offer a thought, we had three people at the end that weren't here, so we kind of picked up the minutes, and I don't want to hear from members to Bill. I just
I know I wasn't invited, but I can't.
You weren't invited.
Mr. Chairman, Bill,
who are you?
I also represent the Federally Qualified Health Centers here in Minnesota, and with me is Jonathan Watson, the Vice President of the organization. I don't know where Mr. Scandrett is. I give apologies. I was trying to reach him, and I know he intended to be here. So.
No, that's fine. Just give us a minute on community, why you're so important, and just a few thoughts you have for us, how we get through this time.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me down. I learned where to sit now in this room. So. Anyway. As many of you know, community health centers, we serve about 200,000 patients across the state. A lot of them, 92%, have incomes below 200% of poverty, and about 42% of them are on a Minnesota Care Medicaid program. So the cuts are particularly devastating to us. We're estimating, looking at the governor's budget in total between the eligibility cuts and the cuts of the dental program, roughly 7 to 9% of our total patients would be affected in terms of losing public coverage. And what we feel is that indeed they are indeed healthcare homes, so these folks would tend to stay with us but come to us as uninsured patients at that point. So it's kind of a double whammy for us. And this is coupled with the fact that with the economy turning the way it is, people losing their employer-sponsored coverage. We see about 11 to 12% increase in the numbers of uninsured anyway, year to year. So we would have in the range of a 15 to 17% increase in uninsured, given the governor's cuts to the program. So we do provide cost-effective care, and some of our clinical measures are particularly helpful in looking at, because we do save the state money in terms of particularly those folks with chronic diseases. Managing their care. We have a pilot project now with two community health centers, and we've seen reductions in the A1C levels reducing nearly, I think, 70% of the people in that project have seen their A1C levels reduced. So keeping those chronic chronic conditions healthy is vital to saving money in the long term. So. And with regards to the entire safety net that Michael Scandrett represents, I know some of the concerns with the hospital cuts, our partners with that are devastating as well. So the system for the low income, the safety net, are particularly hard. It's almost a double whammy. It is a double whammy for us. So does that help?
Yeah. Chairman, just briefly, one other thing that we wanted to point out to you is the Community Health Center's Fair Pay Act that we are introducing in this session. We are severely behind to the tune of $5 million in money that we believe that the Department of Human Services owes us. We've visited with many of you, and Representative Murphy is carrying that bill. We look forward to moving that bill this session.
You know, and just to that, when I asked, is that Mr. Coleman's department? He didn't, what department, who would be the commissioner in charge of that?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Osberg, yeah. That's something that, you know, keep it up. It seems like it's... Do you want to spend a minute on that? Why do they owe you the money?
Mr. Chairman, we'd love to spend a minute.
Well, we got a minute and a half, so
there is
take all the time.
There is a program that we have called a prospective payment system. It's a little bit different for Medicaid than for all the other providers, but it's intended to help the federally qualified health centers because they do deal with so many more uninsured people, and give them an extra payment to help them deal and offset with that group. We have to settle up with the Department of Human Service every year after we finish collecting data from the health plans that are paid and work through that system with the Department of Human Services. We had a back payment backlog in 2001. We fixed that through legislation by giving them an auditor and caught up in 2003. Since then, we haven't caught up again, and that's why we're back to see you again and to try and fix that problem. We don't think it should be an ongoing problem, and our problem says we're going to fix it for now. We're going to set up a new system for the future, and we won't have the problem again and be back here bothering you.
And, Mr. Chair, just the impact of that delayed payments, too, is that a lot of community health centers have to go out and secure loans and get lines of credit. And because of that backlog of payments, they have a cash flow problem. So when you're a safety net provider with razor thin margins, if you even have a profit, how small it is, it's just not wise business to be having to go out and secure loans when there's a federal law that says these payments must be made every 4 months.
And you are the backstop. So members, have 30 seconds. Anybody want to offer a question or anything? Oh, is there a last other witness?
Do I have 30 seconds?
Well, we'll give you a minute. Come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks. Get out of the way, Phil. And that's
thanks.
Yeah, welcome.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lisa Fink, and I'm an attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And we are a nonprofit organization that's provided legal services to low-income Minnesotans of all ages for more than 30 years. As many before me have testified, the cuts to health care programs proposed by the governor would be simply devastating for thousands of Minnesotans, including our legal aid clients. Although we anticipate the governor will adjust his budget to take advantage of incentives in the stimulus package, these incentives primarily protect parents from eligibility cuts. An estimated 113,000 Minnesotans, including more than 26,000 children, will lose vital health care services, and particularly single adults would no longer be eligible for health insurance coverage under Minnesota Care. For all these reasons and more, we thank you and we support you in the very challenging work you are doing as state legislators to develop strategies to both balance the budget and also protect the health of the citizens of Minnesota now and in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And we're on time. We heard from 30 people or better. And I thank you for your comments. We're listening and help us through this. We're in this together. With that, we're adjourned.